From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we take a look at the ACLU's nationwide push to strengthen its political influence.
The political director's job has meant mobilizing our power, and our power is generally with people. It's with activists all across the country who are eager and fired up for a new direction for our country. They see an assault on civil rights and civil liberties like never before in their lifetimes, and they want to do something about it.
And the roller coaster ride that is the Rep's new production of Holmes and Watson just keeps accelerating.
That is what made it necessary for us to really negotiate, navigate, okay, where are these turns and how sharp are they and how do we articulate them for an audience who may be seeing this for the first time because it's so new.
Plus, we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend comes your way after this news update.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. When Faz Shakir joined the ACLU this past January, the organization was still preparing for the inauguration of Donald Trump. Months prior to Shakir's arrival, the ACLU released a letter addressed to Trump threatening to sue him if he acted on several of his campaign promises.
He did, and they did. Since his first week in office, the ACLU has been fighting the Trump administration in court. But in conjunction with these legal battles, the ACLU has also been working to build up its political arm in Washington and around the country.
And that's where Shakir comes in. He is the national political director for the ACLU. He was in Milwaukee recently to deliver a speech at the ACLU of Wisconsin. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about his work and the ACLU's position as a political institution.
The ACLU is a 97-year-old legal institution that has been known for filing wonderful cases throughout its history for gender equality and racial equality, marriage equality. But increasingly, since the election of Trump, we feel a need to build up our political muscle because we can't always count on the courts to deliver the most important victories. And quite frankly, at this time, as you look around the country, some of our strength is not in Congress, it's not in the presidency, it's not in state legislatures, it's not in governorships. And you think about how the ACLU, with its mission of trying to change hearts and minds around civil rights and civil liberties in America, can do its job. The political director's job has meant mobilizing our power, and our power is generally with people. It's with activists all across the country who are eager and fired up for a new direction for our country. They see an assault on civil rights and civil liberties like never before in their lifetimes, and they want to do something about it. And so coming in as a new political director in January of this year, I felt like it was really critical that the ACLU needs to build a grassroots mobilization program. It needs to be more communicative with lay people on the street to give activists an opportunity to engage in these fights, to do something, to affiliate with the ACLU to accomplish our mission.
Is the ACLU political?
Yes, the ACLU is a political organization, for sure. It is not a partisan organization. I would make a distinction between those two. Partisan, of course, it means that you're advocating for the election or defeat of a particular candidate by virtue of their identification with the Democratic Party, Republican Party, or any other party. But we're a political organization that advocates for policy change. That's what I call a political advocacy organization. Someone who is looking to change surveillance laws in our country, the laws that govern reproductive health, the laws that govern LGBT equality. Those are things that we care deeply about. We fight for them in the courts, but we also fight for them in state legislatures. And because we do that, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us to utilize every tool at our disposal. So as I was saying, it's not just litigating in courts. It's not just calling up a few state lawmakers and saying, hey, can you do this wonderful thing? It's got to be broader than that, particularly at this day and age when the threats are so grave and we seem to be constantly playing on defense on many of these issues. So we've got to mobilize the public, and that has been at the forefront of every thought of building up a new political program at the ACLU.
When we say mobilize the public, I feel like we hear these kinds of terms a lot, but they end up being these sort of amorphous terms for what?
Yeah.
What does mobilizing the public actually look like?
It's a great question, and I think of it as in two buckets. There's one that's just the Women's March style mobilization, like get out, get your voices heard. Or what we did during the Affordable Care Act, call your member of Congress, just pick up the phone and do something. When we were building our political program, we wanted to join in all of those things, but we really had a different model of what we thought mobilization should be. Our program is called People Power. You can access it at peoplepower.org. We built it on a creed and a belief. We wanted to give people a meaningful action that they could take in their community to accomplish policy change. Let me give you a specific example of what we said. So we're like, okay, I want to empower volunteer activists to be pseudo-staff of the ACLU, to accomplish things that we as ACLU staff alone could not do. And so one of the first things we said is let's mobilize to protect immigrants all across the nation from Trump's mass deportation agenda. And let's try to build freedom cities, what we call freedom cities, and change some of the laws in our cities that pertain to how cops can ask you about your status and how long they can keep you in jail and what they can pull you into jail for. And we mobilized all across the country asking volunteer activists to advocate for a set of model rules and ordinances pertaining to immigration laws. Sanctuary city type laws. And we said, you know, we can't do this ourselves. So we're turning the ball over to you. We would appreciate if you could go meet with your local sheriff, your local law enforcement, your mayor, your city council, and see if they'd be willing to adopt these welcoming ordinances. And oh my God, it's amazing. When you ask people to step up and you treat them with respect and you give them a high bar, an ambitious goal, they take to it. So all across the country, we've seen Ann Arbor, Michigan, take this up and pass it. Dane County here, Madison, passed it. Phoenix, Arizona, Middlesex County, New Jersey, Berwyn, Illinois, Rockville, Maryland, Silver City, New Mexico. All across the country, they shock you and surprise you because they took it upon themselves to advocate for the policy change that they wanted to see with just a little guidance from the ACLU.
One of the things you just mentioned is kind of the fight against a lot of the proposals from the Trump administration. So even before Trump gets into office, the ACLU had already built out a plan of how to combat some of the things he was proposing. They accused him of essentially going against the Constitution. After his election, the head of the ACLU sends him a letter, you know, citing which amendments he would be going against. What's happened since then? You know, there were all these plans to do all of these different things. What's happened?
Oh, man. It's been a whirlwind. It's been a whirlwind. So flashing back to the middle of last year, we're in the middle of like the DNC convention, the Republican convention, and most people— check me on this, but most people were like, oh, you know, Hillary's on the path to winning. And so here, Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, is urging the entire institution to do a documentation of Trump's policy positions and identify where his policies might be in contravention of the Constitution. And he's asking his staff to do that. And most of the people are like, why? Like, don't you know Hillary's going to win? And so we produce the Trump memos. And it provided the guide map for the possibility that Trump might win. And guess what? He did. And it positioned the ACLU, I think, to have an approach right out of the box. And as you suggested and mentioned, on the day after he was elected, we wrote a letter in the New York Times, took out a full-page ad, and said, we'll see you in court. If you pursue all of the unconstitutional threats and pledges that you've made during the course of the campaign, we documented them all across the board. If you pursue these, then we're going to challenge you in court. And we have done that. So 1 week in to the administration, right? He's inaugurated on January 20th. 1 week in, January 27th, he issues the Muslim ban. And within hours, we're in a Brooklyn courtroom and successfully win a lawsuit there. Almost every court across America after that ruled against him, not only on the Muslim ban 1.0, but then 2.0. We're still stuck in a legal morass over that as he tries to pursue a discriminatory law. So it wasn't just the Muslim ban. We've been so busy on so many immigration matters.
Now, you're actually the son of immigrants from Pakistan. Yeah. How personal are these battles for you?
You know, I was raised Muslim. I have a funny name. I'm a brown-skinned person. And there are days when I wake up and I hear the things that Trump says, I'm like, man, this guy thinks I am the enemy. He thinks, like, essentially, I need to be kicked out of this country, or I need to be surveilled. I need to that I am a threat. And it doesn't feel good. But the fact that there are so many people who affiliate and sound support for this perspective is heartwarming. I mean, you remember, I was just referring to the Muslim ban. The story of the Muslim ban was that thousands upon thousands of non-Muslims rushed into airports to defend their Muslim brothers and sisters, their neighbors. And seeing the reaction from such a broad swath of the American public said, hell no, like, this is not what we stand for. That makes it all much, much better.
Now, I'm not sure how familiar you might be with this particular situation, but I was listening to a program the other day about the decades-long surveillance of Muslim communities in the United States. So that has been, they FOIA requested quite a lot of documents, thousands upon thousands of documents about these mostly just everyday people, families, kids, who the FBI, I should say, is keeping documents on. How much is the ACLU involved in that case?
Very much. We've had an issue where we've been fighting with the New York City Police Department over a lot of the practices that you said, surveillance of Muslim communities, going into mosques and tracking individuals, guilt by association. This is really essentially the problem that we face in the Muslim community, is that for so long, it was the Kevin Bacon game, you know, 7 degrees association with a terrorist. And they'd start with, oh, there's some guy from Hamas and there's some guy from Hezbollah. And like, he had a brother and then he married some sister and then he had 3 kids and then he had a friend and then he had an uncle and that uncle met with you and therefore you're a terrorist. That game has been played against every major Muslim who has risen to high office or become a public figure. I mean, you think of Keith Ellison, a congressman from Minnesota, just been dogged by, oh, he's a terrorist and we can't trust him. He affiliates with terrorist groups. There were individuals who served in the Bush White House, Suhail Khan, and a couple of other people who were attacked by conservatives. They were Republicans working for President Bush, and they were attacked by conservatives like Frank Gaffney, who said that they were inviting terrorists into the White House and they shouldn't be trusted. Certainly, you know, when I joined Nancy Pelosi's staff and Harry Reid's staff, there were articles online saying that, you know, I was a terrorist fundraiser because I had been in the Harvard Islamic Society. And that was it. Literally, I was in the Harvard Islamic Society and therefore I'm a terrorist. So it is the game that has been played all too often to detrimental effect and has really depressed many in the Muslim community from participating in American civic life. They're worried that any time they try to run for office or get involved in something high profile that they're going to be attacked in the same way. And so the ACLU has been heavily engaged in this. And we fight over things like the designation of terrorist groups or the government for a very long time. The designation of terrorist groups. We want to, of course, designate terrorist groups and we want it to be particularized and focused on actual terrorists. But what too often happens is the designation will then be broad enough that you can say, oh, well, anybody, you know, everybody who might have even said something in a certain way becomes a terrorist. They said Allahu Akbar, you know, and then therefore that becomes a grave threat. And as an organization committed to free speech, we want to make sure that we have an open society, a tolerant and accepting society, and punish wrongdoing and evildoing when it occurs through actual physical violence, through heinous harm inflicted upon others. But we don't want to punish people for merely having a point of view and a perspective.
Well, and on that point, the ACLU has taken a lot of heat for their representation of white supremacists. Most recently, there's a situation going on with Taylor Swift, whose lawyers sent a letter to a conservative blogger who essentially said that she was involved with white supremacy. Why does the ACLU continue to represent and defend white supremacists?
Because we believe in free speech for everybody. If you really believe in free speech for all, you're going to be tested in that belief by others who are going to pick the least popular group and push that group onto you and say, hey, you want free speech for that person? And if you allow for the encroachment upon speech restrictions for, let's say, white supremacists, you know who's coming next? It's going to be Black Lives Matter. It's going to be Greenpeace activists. It's going to be abortion protesters, abortion rights protesters. It's going to be pro-Palestinian protesters, right? All of these folks, marginalized or unpopular groups, people who have a thought that is considered on the fringe, they're going to be penalized and criminally punished for a point of view. That's something we are vigilantly on guard about. So we've defended in Charlottesville and in so many places the right of people with whom we disagree vehemently on racial justice matters, the right to speak. You know, as a political director, I'm not launching these lawsuits, but I am trying to mobilize the public around what we're trying to accomplish. And I think it's important that, you know, we're an organization that believes in more speech. Let's have more speech. And the best way that you can reject speech that you hate is by not showing up. I mean, imagine if an Ann Coulter or a Milo or Steve Bannon shows up to a college campus and has to speak to a room of 10 people. That's embarrassing. That's sad for them. And that's the way it should be. And I think oftentimes the effort to try to repress their speech only gets them more attention and gives them the satisfaction that they're looking for. So I think that from our perspective, we're trying to mobilize people in the instances where we end up representing somebody whose values we abhor. We're going to continue at the ACLU to mobilize the public in contravention to that person's ideas. So we'll represent a white supremacist in court, but we will simultaneously be mobilizing public to attend rallies or protests in defiance of the views of that person. We're going to live our values. We're going to live the fact that we believe in more speech, and we're going to promote more speech.
What is the ACLU's view on hate speech? Because I think that's where a lot of people get caught up. You mentioned Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. Greenpeace, and these organizations, yes, say things that a lot of people don't maybe agree with, but rarely do they engage in hate speech, in speech that encourages violence, unlike many of these white supremacist groups.
You use the key word there, violence. And that's where we draw a line. If you're coming to instigate violence, that's not speech. That's actually repressing speech. That's intimidating, right? That it's going to stop people from exercising their First Amendment right. And I think Charlottesville certainly caused our organization to become clearer about that. And I think the challenge with Charlottesville is when we represented the client there, he testified that he would not be engaging in a violent protest. Of course, we saw what ended up happening. And so should we and others who represent groups like that be more discerning or critical of the pledges that they make to us as our clients, right? So they say, hey, no, we're not going to bring guns to this march. We're not going to engage in any violence. We need to probably engage in a much stronger effort to check that pledge that they're making to us and to critique it, to assess whether we think that's valid and whether they're going to hold to that. So that is one takeaway from Charlottesville, is that we probably got to be much more discerning about challenging the claims that people make to us. Secondly, when people are bringing arms to a protest, we've been clear that we're not going to represent you. When you bring guns, it too often is going to repress speech. It's going to intimidate others from not showing up, from being able to voice their opinion. And that's not a road that we want to go down.
All right. Well, Faz, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Faz Shakir is the National Political Director for the ACLU. He was in Milwaukee to deliver a speech at the ACLU of Wisconsin. There's more information at WUWM.com.
Up next, we'll catch up with two of the stars of the Milwaukee Rep's new production of Holmes and Watson, a conversation with actors Norman Moses and Mark Corkins when Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Last weekend saw the opening of Holmes and Watson at the Milwaukee Rep. This production is the Midwest premiere of the play, and it's directed by the Rep's former artistic director, Joe Hanready.
It stars Norman Moses and Mark Corkins, two men very familiar to Milwaukee theater audiences. Between them, they have more than 60 years of onstage experience, and in this play, they get to show off all of that skill and experience to great theatrical effect.
I met with Corkins and Moses at the Rep during a rehearsal a couple of weeks before the show opened, and they obliged then by offering us this tidbit from Holmes and Watson.
So, is the great detective here among us?
Well, they are rather similar.
That has been the challenge.
Of course, it has been 3 years, and none of these men appear to be at his physical best.
I hope you're not saying you don't recognize him. If you can't identify Mr. Holmes, I haven't a clue where we'll turn. His brother Mycroft is reported to be on a mission of great sensitivity and cannot be reached. Your former landlady, Mrs. Hudson, is visiting her sister somewhere in the wilds of Wales. There aren't even any photographs of Mr. Holmes to make comparisons.
Yes, I fear Holmes was notorious for not allowing his picture to be taken. Perhaps the patients might, speak?
To you?
Yes.
What would you propose be the subject of your exchange?
His return to life. How we survived the falls at Reichenbach.
Reichenbach.
You are acquainted with the incident.
Not comprehensively. I know it was reported on at the time.
The particulars were extremely condensed. My own was the fullest account.
I'm afraid I haven't read it. I don't care much for fiction.
My stories are not fiction.
They are stories, though. They appear alongside fiction in the popular press?
Guilt by association?
Surely you don't claim they have the same veracity as news items?
I take great pains in my writing to represent the incidents as accurately as possible.
I'm sorry. But accounts written long after the events they purport to portray, combined with the demands of the market to satisfy the public taste, do suggest a certain, shall we say, imprecision.
What do you know of the case?
Just that Mr. Holmes died following an altercation with a retired teacher.
Professor Moriarty was the Napoleon of crime.
Delusions of grandeur there.
Gentlemen, it is so great to see you both again. Thank you for that reading.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Good to see you, Bonnie.
This must be fun.
We are having a great time. It is such a great group of artists, and the play is such a challenge and so much fun. We laugh a lot. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, and you get to do voices. Accents.
We do. Actually, Claire Hayden, our dialect coach, was the person who first thought, hey, what if Dr. Evans was a Scot? And it made sense. It takes place in Scotland off the coast of Starkhaven.
So, without giving anything away, Norman, can you give me an idea of the premise of the play?
Well, if you were read any of the Sherlock Holmes canon, there is one of the stories, The Final Problem. And people may know this from the Sherlock Holmes movie with Robert Downey Jr. It's when Professor Moriarty and Sherlock Holmes have a final struggle at the falls of Reichenbach, which is a very high falls, and they both fall over the edge of the falls and are both presumed dead. And it is a period of about 3 years, and then eventually Sherlock Holmes does resurface. And this kind of takes place in between The Final Problem, which is the last one of one series of his books, and the beginning of the next series, which is, I think, that The Empty House is where Holmes makes his return. So our play kind of takes place sort of not quite in between. It's not based on any real story. He's taken information from the stories and created his own premise. And Watson has been called upon to identify people claiming to be Sherlock Holmes over the past several years.
So he hasn't resurfaced yet.
He hasn't resurfaced in this in our version. So Watson is sort of the debunker. He goes and he gets this mysterious message, a telegram saying that there are three people claiming to be Sherlock Holmes on an island in an asylum in Scotland. And it takes him
in
about
the winter too, right?
Very exclusive. Yeah. Yes, and somewhat remote. isolated, one might say.
Yes.
So
there are fairies involved.
Fairies,
yes.
and skiffs and it's shallops.
Yes.
All these these great boats.
Police cutters.
Police cutters. Yeah, a lot of boats. I didn't even think of that.
And Mark, you are Dr. Evans, who is sort of in charge of this.
Yes, I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm the, shall we say, chief medical officer of this rather exclusive asylum. And I'm the one who admits in a very short span of time three individuals, all of whom certainly fit the physical description of Sherlock Holmes, but they're all claiming in one way or another to be the late great detective. And as you heard in the scene, we've reached out to Holmes' brother and his former landlady, and we've sent a telegram to Dr. Watson in London to see if he'd be willing to come out and interview the gang.
Yes, because Dr. Watson would know.
He would know. He would know, which is the real Sherlock Holmes, even though it's been a few years and Holmes is notorious for disguises. But that's the idea, is that he would instantaneously know who he was. But things are not always are not what they seem to be at the asylum. So Watson kind of goes on the defensive a little bit to try to figure out
what's really happening.
What's really happening.
Well, and the layers that are written, that Jeffrey Hatcher has written into this, are delicious. I mean, there's so much that you think you figured it out, and you haven't. And again, without giving anything away, was it fun for you when you sat down with the whole cast to actually work your way through the actual script to the end?
Yes. Joe Hanratty, our director, has assembled a cast of not only very talented actors, but really smart, curious people. And we ran into, during our several table days over the table, looking at the script, lots of places where, hey, wait a minute, wait, how does this connect? And then we all put our heads together, and we think we found. we were just aware of the fact that there will be Holmesians out there. There's going to be fans who are very familiar with the canon. And what are we going to say at talkbacks when people who really know the material ask us, hey, what about? And I think we've done pretty well.
We have, and it's been a real process. The play is so layered, as you say, that every day you'd go home and you start thinking about stuff. You think you'd found a hole in the script. Oh, Jeffrey's, slipped up here. This doesn't make sense. This couldn't have happened in this situation. Then you go home and you start thinking about it. And all of it kind of, you start piecing things that you've heard in the play. And it's like, oh, God, how stupid am I that I didn't put that together? Oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. And it's just been a process of every day. It's sort of like a new revelation. And you bring that in, you're sharing those ideas. And it's like, oh, no, it's not really quite what we thought it was. It really is more this, and it's just much more interesting and intriguing that way. So it's been a real challenge, and like Mark says, it's got a room full of really bright people who just are sort of relentless in their in their dedication.
That's what you want, relentless actors.
Yeah. And Joe is a very, very smart director, and all of us putting our heads together, the hive mind, I think, as Mark said, I think we have figured it out. There are a couple of moments still that I am not quite 100% sure about, but I think that kind of makes it fun a little bit. It's a sort of an unknown moment in the play that even we as the characters are not quite sure what's going on with each other, and
Yeah, the other thing that is somewhat unique about this play is, we started doing run-throughs here in the rehearsal hall maybe a week ago, and we were coming in under 80 minutes, right, and knowing that once we add all of the technical elements that will flesh out, and then of course, a theater full of people will also add a little time. But it's amazing that it's like getting on a ride, and it just keeps accelerating. there's a few little, slower moments, memory sequences. But it's really exhilarating, and that is what made it necessary for us to really navigate, okay, where are these turns, and how sharp are they, and how do we articulate them for an audience who may be obviously seeing this for the first time because it's so new, but also maybe people who the only thing they know about Sherlock Holmes is the pipe and the deerstalker hat. Maybe they've never read or seen a film. So it has been really exhilarating.
Have you gone back to read the originals, either of you?
Yeah, actually, Mark and I worked together this summer up at Door Shakespeare, and I bought the two-volume set of the... I did not make it through both of them, but I made it through most of the first one, and it just gave me a real sense of Doyle's style of writing, and it's very narrative. It's everybody tells their story, and that's how Holmes kind of puts the pieces together, besides all of his powers of observation. And I think Jeffrey's been really, really loyal to just the style of language and you know everything about the books. So,
and for you, Mark,
it's interesting. I grew up not being able to read, and only years later finding out, oh, I'm dyslexic. So it was a struggle for me to read on my own. But my father, gratefully. He, once we got done with the Hardy Boys, started reading us the Sherlock Holmes canon as bedtime stories, and I was just hooked. The stories are so compelling, and I don't know if it's in our DNA, this thing about following a trail and, you know, tracking things, trying to figure things out. So almost all the stories, I see, oh, Red-Headed League, I go, oh, I remember that, and I know what it was about, and I have gone back to the specific stories that are mentioned in this play, and maybe 12 years ago, we did Stephen Dietz, Sherlock Holmes, the final Adventure, I think it was called, which combines some of the well-known later stories, A Scandal in Bohemia, which is mentioned in this play
yes.
as well. So I'm pretty darn familiar. I don't think I'm a geek about it, but I certainly do appreciate it. I remember when my mother told me, I must have been 11 or something, you know there's a society called the Baker Street Irregulars, and they behave as though Sherlock Holmes is a real person, and they get together and discuss the minutiae of the stories. I was like, really?
Did you join?
I didn't join. You know? I could now, though.
You could. Yeah. Both of you could. I'm just sitting here listening to you two. When was the last time you were in a show together, besides the Door County?
I was doing a little research this morning on my computer. I keep my database of all the shows I've done. And Mark, actually, and I, the last time we worked together on the Powerhouse stage here at the Rep was in 1988. Well, it would have been 1989, but it was when his daughter, Molly, was born. And several months after that, my daughter, Kelsey, was born. We were doing Precious Memories.
Yeah,
Molly was born. I looked that up.
Yes,
played by Romulus Linney, directed by John Dillon. This was during the John Dillon era.
Wow.
And then we were doing She Stoops to Conquer
when
Ken Albers
directed that. Yeah.
That's when my daughter was born, and our understudies had to go on for us.
That's right. It's been a while.
It's 20. So it's as old as our children are.
I was going to say almost 30 years.
Yeah, almost 30 years. Yeah.
That's amazing. Because I was thinking. You know, I've interviewed you both for different shows over the years since I've been here, and I've been here almost 12 years, and I thought, they've never been in a show together that I've talked to you about. And so that I was trying to think. And so, no, I wasn't around the last time you were on the Powerhouse stage together.
We did do the Scottish play with Milwaukee Shakespeare.
Yes, and I think that was the last time. And that was what, 2007?
Seven sounds right.
Yeah. So 10 years ago. Yes.
Well, I don't know. It feels like our lives are much more intertwined than maybe, you know, that resume of
indicates,
shared. Yeah, it's interesting.
And here we are back in Scotland.
Scotland, yes. Right.
Different part of Scotland, I think, but in a different era. But anyway, it must feel good to be back on stage again.
It is. It's been 30 years since I've been on the Powerhouse. You know, that was the last time we worked together, and that was the last time I did a show there. So I'm very excited to get back. It was interesting walking the halls and... that's one of the things I really felt is just, boy, how many shows have taken place in that theater in the last 30 years. And, you know, I don't know. It's putting on a play is a real
it consumes your life, you know, and you think of all the times that that has happened, and, you know, in that space, it's kind of special.
And you're carrying it on with this one.
We are.
There's some amazing language in this one.
Sure is. And Joe is quite, he's very demanding in terms of the specificity and being spot on in terms of the saying all the words in the right order, which you may take for granted, but there's really, as Joe said, there's very little margin for error. That it really is a dance between flow and great specificity, which takes a lot of repetition, a lot of going back, and as he reminded us, rehearsal is rehearing. Mm-hmm. So. And I love the fact that Joe is, he's attracted to plays that demand heightened language, and then that calls for working with actors who are capable of making the delineations and kinds of adjustments that he will call for. And sometimes you'll say, wow, I didn't even think of that particular, spin on a line. But it's nice to be able to make those adjustments.
Well, in a play like this, too, if you messed something up, you could give away the whole thing. and no pressure, at all. But you really could. You could mess it up.
Sure, well, that's true of any play, but...
But particularly one that hangs so, so much on not giving things away until the proper time.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, all in good time is very much a part of this play, because otherwise... You just skip to the end, and you don't want to do that. Because as a reader and somebody who's going to watch this, I want to enjoy the journey of getting there.
Because
that's just so much fun. And that's, to me, it seems like it's so much fun for you to play as well.
Well, it's going to be fun for the audience to see if they can figure out.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think if they get it, they'll just it's just going to be a lucky guess.
I do too. Well, gentlemen, always great to see you both.
Always great to talk to you.
And thank you so much for taking some time out of rehearsal.
We do appreciate you coming in to join us.
Yeah,
thank you.
Bonnie. Thank you.
Mark Corkins and Norman Moses star in the Midwest premiere of Jeffrey Hatcher's Holmes and Watson. It opened last weekend at the Milwaukee Rep and runs through mid-December. There is more information at WUWM.com.
We will take one more break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal stories.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is Ex Fabula Radio Time once again on Lake Effect Weekend on WUWM. Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Winter. Desiree Constantino from Ex Fabula is here once again this week, pinch hitting for Leah Delaney. And seeing as how it is Thanksgiving weekend, Des, I think we can officially say 'tis the season.
'Tis the season indeed.
And that's our theme for today.
Yes, we're trying to get into, this weekend we've got a little bit of fun and then a little bit of kind of heartwarming pay it forward thoughts in mind.
And our first story is one of those pay it forward kind of stories. That's one of those feel good stories for this family.
It is. Mary Wacker took our stage in April of last year Only in Milwaukee Story Slam. And, this is a nice one that I think this weekend a lot of people could take some time to maybe be a little kind as we're all shopping and being a little crazy for the next couple weeks.
Okay, here it is.
So this is a story about, I think something that's uniquely Milwaukee is the generosity of spirit. So this is a story about that. But even like 5 minutes ago in the ladies' room, I get in a stall, I kind of run back there, hadn't taken my purse. I'm peeing, no toilet paper. And I'm thinking, oh, I should have checked. It's a cardinal rule. That's why I carry a purse, you have Kleenex. Out comes a hand. I didn't say a word, this is all in my head. Under the stall comes a hand saying, you're gonna need this, and it's full of toilet paper. I'm like, yes, yes! Oh, whoever that was, thank you. All I know is your hand. All right. Clearly that person had been in my stall and had been a little more prepared to check first. But anyways, the story I want to tell is, I don't go to Woodman's that often. I'm kind of not in that neighborhood. But I happened to be there last summer and did a bunch of shopping and love Woodman's. It's just kind of interesting, cool vibe. Lots of stuff that I found. And I'm checking out, and the store's kind of empty. I'd kind of gotten there around 4 o'clock, and not much was going on. And I'm in the checkout, and I totally forget that it is a debit card-only store. And I'm trying to use my credit card, and it's not going through. And the checkout person is so kind, and she's like, you know, is that a credit card? And I'm like, yeah, oh, that's right, you do debit. So I pull out my debit card, which I'm really well-versed in using, because at that time, Aldi's only did debit cards. And but I'm short, and the machine is, like, up here, and I'm, like, trying to push buttons, and I'm not quite seeing what I'm pushing, and after 3 tries, I couldn't get my PIN in correctly, and it eats my card. You know, it kind of freezes my card, and I'm sitting there going, oh, and all this is taking time. And first of all, I'm one of these people who's pretty impatient, and I kind of have great parking karma, but I have really bad grocery store checkout line karma. I'm always in the slow line where people are digging in their purse for pennies and, you know, counting out change laboriously and, you know, just kind of like, oh, God, why me? Why is this line? Every other line is 3 people past and I could have been there. And I'm thinking, oh, this is so poetic justice. Here I am, the holdup in the line, and I am like completely, like, what am I going to do? And so the bill was $55, and I had $40 in cash. And I'm thinking, okay, what am I going to do? Well, I could put some things back. And I hear this voice behind me. So I had not looked up after all this drama of credit card and debit card and conversation with the checkout person. And I look up, and there are 4 people behind me in line with huge baskets, because now it's the after work crowd, the moms that have come to do their shopping, and they just want to get through. And I'm their worst nightmare. And I am so mortified. I'm just like, I want to scream out, really, I have my own business. I'm not an idiot. I do know how to do this. But the woman behind me, so before I even look around, I hear this voice going, I'll get it. And she hands a debit card for it. And I look at her going, no, you can't do that. I'm just like, no, you can't pay for my groceries. I can pay for my groceries. And she says, no, and she had the nicest smile on her face. It wasn't resentful. It wasn't like, if this is what I have to do to be able to check out. It was just like, no, really, it's okay. And I'm just like, I can't let you, and I give her the $40, she won't take it. The checkout woman says, I'll take it. Should I reduce your bill by $40? I said, yes. The woman paid $15. She said, pay it forward. 2 weeks later, I'm in Aldi's, and these kids in front of me, teenagers, are basically digging in their purse for change and pennies, and they're short, like by $8. And I hand a 20 forward, and I say, here, I'll get it. And they say, no, you can't do it. I said, really? Someone did this for me 2 weeks ago. And the woman behind me is like, bless your heart. And I'm thinking, only in Milwaukee.
And that was Mary Walker from our Only in Milwaukee Story Slam in April of 2016.
You know, she said she has bad checkout line karma. She's not the only one. I always seem to get into the wrong aisle where someone, not necessarily coming up short of money, but this credit card won't work. Let's try this one. Or this debit card won't work. So, yeah, that's my karma, too.
Yeah, I tend to be the one that no matter what I do, I always want somebody to bag my groceries. So, I'm kind of lazy that way. So,
so next event coming up is a Secret Fabula event for you guys.
It is. Secret Fabula is one of those member benefits. So, membership is a great stocking stuffer. If you are not already an ex-Fabula member, now might be a great time to do that because you can get into this Secret Fabula event for free. And it's on December 5th, and it's Secret Fabula, the Milwaukee Housing Marches through the UWM Archives. And we'll be exploring the history and personal stories of the housing marches at this intimate event. And, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of the Milwaukee Housing Marches. And so there's been events and will continue to be events through the New Year's to really understand and go deeper into those historical events.
And more information about ex-Fabula memberships and events and everything is at exfabula.org.
Yes, indeed.
And our second story.
Our second story comes from Ed Makowski. And this is actually a story told at our very first ex-Fabula slam back in November of 2009. Yeah, we're taking it way back.
My name's Edmund, to be exact. My dad's name is Ed, and when my mom went to go meet the in-laws, she met another guy named Ed, my grandfather, and so she married an Ed, she had an Ed, eventually my dad died, she buried an Ed. A couple years later, she met another guy, yeah, his name's Ed. But with an O, Edmund with an O, he's from Canada. And they don't know how to spell Ed there. And so then I found out I was going to be a dad. And, there's nothing wrong with my name and my dad's name and my grandpa's name. So he's an Ed. So my mom has all these Eds. She's surrounded by them. But before little Ed became, most people, they're like, oh, I'm going to have a kid. I should get a real job and have some health insurance and make money and, do all these logical things. And instead, I met this guy at a lunch counter who invited me to come sell Christmas trees in Florida. And I said, okay, that sounds so weird. I have to. So I did. They flew me out there, paid for all of my food, which is wonderful because I love to eat. And we got there. They drive up, okay, this is our house. Get there. They're renting this house instead of staying in a hotel. The house, since the housing market in Florida is so awful, we are renting a house on the Gulf of Mexico. There's 20 feet of grass behind the house, 30 feet of sand, water. So the first thing I did the night after we got there was run to Target and buy a tent so I could sleep out in the backyard. Come to find out, this company specializes in large, high-quality trees for rich people, delivering them there, setting them up, spinning them around. How does this look? You make kind of a show out of it. The owner's the good cop, as you were saying before. The underling is the bad cop. Oh, I don't know, it looks good. Nope, it's better this way. Oh, yeah, you're right, So these two women came in. They came there every year, bought three trees. These gals were lesbians. They were a couple. They've been coming in there for years. And they bought three trees to put in their house. They must have a lot of money, I figure. So we get there to deliver the trees, to set them up. And the first floor, the basement, is a garage which has two Porsches, a Subaru, and a couple of other vehicles. And I'm just like, wow. And they're right on the water somewhere. So we walk in with the first large tree. We're carrying it under our arms. I think it was a 12-foot tall Fraser tree. And out of the corner of my eye, I think, man, I think that looks like a Roy Lichtenstein painting. I see all these dots and it's all shiny. But we have to go set up the tree, so I go do that. I notice there's all this artwork all over the place. I think it was George O'Keefe stuff, Mapplethorpe stuff, and I'm like, wow, I don't know anyone that has this stuff in their house. I'm from Milwaukee. I don't know people with money, even by Milwaukee standards. And so we get downstairs, we set up all the trees. I go down and look. So they've got a Lichtenstein sitting in their hall. You know, like every night they wake up to go pee in the middle of the night, they're walking past an original Roy Lichtenstein painting, and I can't even believe it. And I kind of run outside, and I'm like looking for someone to tell this to. And I see the gardener. He's like a 60-year-old man with all these funky skin lesions going on. He's spent his life gardening in Florida. He's probably got several cancers. And I say, they've got an original Lichtenstein in there. And he goes, and I said, I know, I've never seen one in person. I've only seen them in museums. And blah, blah, blah. I go on, and he goes, a what? And I said, Roy Lichtenstein, the pop art painter. They've got an original Lichtenstein painting in there. And he goes, oh, a painting. He goes, they got a painting of a naked woman in there. And I said, yeah, okay. And I kind of walked over to our truck. We left, the season went well. I went home, a month later had a kid, Edmund V. Everything went well.
And that was Ed Makowski from Beginnings, our first Ex-Fabulous Slam ever.
That's amazing. And the story of, you know, heading to Florida to sell Christmas trees to people with a lot of money.
Yeah, no kidding. That would have been quite a sight.
Well, let's review what you got coming up here. The Secret Fabula and memberships. And
Secret Fabula, December 14th, we'll have our December Story Slam, which will be, the theme will be traditions. So that should be a fun one. I mean, holidays or not, you know, we all have some kind of quirky traditions we do, even if it's just wearing your lucky socks on Packer Sunday, you know. So I imagine that'll be an exciting one. And then, you know, right now it is the perfect time to go ahead and get that Ex-Fabula membership, not only for yourself, but we do have gift memberships available.
Desiree Constantino filling in again this week for Leah Delaney, who is, I don't know, gallivanting about the world somewhere.
Yeah, she's
on vacation.
In South Africa.
Really,
yeah,
South Africa.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, she is half a world away.
Yes, she is.
Well, thanks for coming in once again. And if you want to share these stories or listen again, they are up at WUWM.com. Des, thank you.
Thanks, Bruce.
Ex-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.